it's time for yet another installment in this extremely high-frequency string of nearly weekly podcasts. It's the Cory Doctorow Podcast. Hello, nice to talk to you. I am still back from my tour, stuck to my home, not traveling, sitting down at my desk every Sunday and recording. It's very nice to have my routine back. I will not be speaking to you next weekend, though, because I will be in Amherst, New York, just outside of Buffalo. I'm going to be keynoting the Media Ecology Association annual conference and getting their Neil Postman Prize for Lifetime Achievement. On the 20th of June, I will be in Oakland, California for the Locus Awards, where I will be giving the keynote in place of Connie Willis, who has taken a bit poorly. I hope she recovers very quickly, and I'm honored to be filling her amazing, brilliant emceeing shoes. On July the 14th, I'll be in New York to do the closing keynote for Hackers on Planet Earth in Queens. On the 20th of July, I'll be in Chicago for the American Association of Law Libraries keynote and for a bookstore appearance. I'll also be at DEF CON giving a talk on enshittification and at Burning Man, where I'll be doing a Q&A at my camp, Liminal Labs, speaking at Palenque Norte, and I believe speaking at Center Camp, although they seem to have dropped off the face of the earth, so we'll find out. This is going to be a great week. My friend Ted Kolchesky has just landed at LAX and is working his way across Los Angeles to come stay with us. We are going to go see Stop Making Sense with Talking Heads in person at the Pantages Theater with my daughter Posey and my friend Taylor and some of Ted's friends as well. Kind of a dream come true. So exciting. All right, so this week's podcast is a piece that I wrote for my newsletter for Pluralistic.net, and it's a piece about writing. It contains some spoilers for the movie Furiosa. They are at the end of this essay, and I will give you lots of warning. You don't have to tune out now. You'll have lots of warning when it's time to tune out if you don't want any Furiosa spoilers. All right, without any further ado then, here from the May 27th edition of Pluralistic.net is Against Lore. One of my favorite nuggets of writing advice comes from James D. McDonald. Jim, a Navy vet with an encyclopedic knowledge of gun lore, explained to a group of non-gun people how to write guns without getting derided by other gun people. Just add the word modified. As in, her modified AR-15 kicked against her shoulder as she squeezed the trigger, but she held it steady on the car door, watching it disintegrate in a spatter of bullet holes. Jim's big idea was that gun people couldn't help but chew away at the verisimilitude of your fictional guns. Their brains would automatically latch onto them and try to find the errors. But the word modified hijacked that impulse and turned it to the writer's advantage. A gun person's imagination gnaws at that word modified, spinning up the cleverest possible explanation for how the gun in question could behave as depicted. In other words, the gun person's impulse to one-up the writer by demonstrating their superior knowledge becomes an impulse to impart that superior knowledge to the writer. Modified puts the expert and the bullshitter on the same team and conscripts the expert into fleshing out the bullshitter's lies. Yeah, writing is lying. Storytelling is genuinely weird. A storyteller who has successfully captured the audience has done so by convincing their hindbrains to care about the tribulations of imaginary people. These are people whose suffering, by definition, does not matter. Imaginary things didn't happen, so they can't matter. The deaths of Romeo and Juliet were less tragic than the death of the yogurt you had for breakfast. That yogurt was alive and now it's dead, whereas R&J never lived, never died, and don't matter. Hijacking a stranger's empathic response is intrinsically adversarial. While storytelling is a benign activity, its underlying mechanism is extremely dangerous. Getting us to care about things that don't matter is how novels and movies work, but it's also how cults and cons work. cult leaders and con artists know that they're engaged in mind-to-mind combat, and they make liberal use of Jim's hack of leaving blank spots for the mark to fill in. Think of QAnon drops. The mystical nonsense was just close enough to sensical that a vulnerable audience was compelled to try and untangle it and ended up imparting more meaning to it than the hustler who posted them could have ever dreamt up. Same with cons. There's a great scene in the Leverage Redemption heist show where an experienced con artist explains to a novice that the most convincing hustle is the one where you wait for the mark to tell you what they think you're doing, then run with it. Scam baiters and other skeptics will recognize this as a relative of the cold reading, where a psychic uses your own confirmations to flesh out their predictions. As Douglas Adams put it, a towel has immense psychological value. For some reason, if a strag, non-hitchhiker, discovers that a hitchhiker has his towel with him, he will automatically assume that he is also in possession of a toothbrush, face flannel, soap, tin of biscuits, flask, compass, map, ball of string, gnat spray, wet weather gear, spacesuit, etc., etc. Furthermore, the strag will then happily lend the hitchhiker any of these or a dozen other items that the hitchhiker might accidentally have lost. What the strag will think is that any man who can hitch the length and breadth of the galaxy, rough it, slum it, struggle against terrible odds, win through, and still know where his towel is clearly a man to be reckoned with. Magicians know this one too. The point of a sleight is to misdirect the audience's attention and use that moment of misattention to trick them, vanishing, stashing, or producing something. The mark's mind is caught in a pleasurable agony. Something seemingly impossible just happened. The mind splits in two parts, one of which insists that the impossible just happened, the other insisting that the impossible can't happen. You know you've done it right when the audience says, "Do that again!" And that's the one thing you must not do. So long as you don't repeat the trick, the audience's imagination will chew on it endlessly, coming up with incredibly clever things that you must have done. A smart conjurer will know several ways to produce the same effect and will do it again by reproducing the effect via different means, which exponentially increases the audience's automatic imputation of clever methods to the performer. Not for nothing, Jim McDonald advises his writing students to study Magic and Showmanship, a classic text for aspiring conjurers. There's a version of this in comedy, too. The scholarship of humor is clear on this. Comedy comes from surprise. The audience knows they're about to be surprised when the punchline lands, and their mind is furiously trying to defuse the comedian's bomb before it detonates, cycling through potential punchlines of their own. This ramps up the suspense and the tension, so when the comedian does drop the punchline, the tension is released in a whoosh of laughter. Your mind wants the tension to be resolved ASAP, but the pleasure comes from having that desire thwarted. Comedy, like most live performance, has an element of authoritarianism. You don't give the audience what it wants, you give it what it needs. Same goes for tabletop role-playing games. The Game Master's role is to deny the players the victories and treasure they want until they can't take it anymore, and then deliver it. That's the definition of an epic game. It's one of the durable advantages of human GMs over video game backends. They can ramp up the epicness by cheating on the play, giving the players the chance to squeak out improbable victories at the last possible second. This is so effective that even crude approximations of it can turn video games into cult hits, like Left 4 Dead, whose director backend would notice when the players were about to get destroyed and then substantially ramp up the chances of finding an amazing weapon. The chance would still be low overall, but there would be enough moments when the player got exactly what they'd been praying for at the last possible instant that it would feel amazing. Critically, Left 4 Dead's director didn't do this every time. As any showman knows, the key to a great performance is always leave 'em wanting more. The musician's successful finale depends on doing every encore the audience demands, except the last one. So the crowd leaves with one tantalizing and imaginary song playing in their minds, a performance better than any the musicians themselves could have delivered. Like the gun person, who comes up with a cooler mod than the writer ever could. Like the magic show attendee, who comes up with a more elaborate explanation for the slight than the conjurer could ever pull off. Like the comedy club attendee, whose imagination anticipates a surprise that grows larger the longer the joke goes on. The successful performance is an adversarial act of cooperation, where the audience willingly and unwillingly cooperates with the performer to deny them the thing that they think they need and deliver the thing that they actually need. This is my biggest problem with the idea that someday LLMs will get good enough at storytelling to give us the tales we demand without having to suffer through a storyteller's sadistic denial of the resolutions we crave. When I'm reading a mystery, I want to turn to the last page and find out who done it, but I know that doing so will ruin the story. Telling the storyteller how the story should go is like trying to tickle yourself. Like being tickled, it's only fun if the tickler respects your boundaries. But, like being tickled, there's always a part where you're squirming away, but don't want it to stop. An AI storyteller that gives you exactly what you want is like a dungeon master who declares that every sword swing kills the monster and every treasure chest is full of epic items and platinum pieces. Yeah, that's what you want, but if you get it, what's the point? Seen in this light, performance is a kind of sadomasochism, where the performer delights in denying something to the audience, who, in turn, delights in the denial. Don't give the audience what they want, give them what they need. What your audience needs is their own imagination. Decades ago, I was a freelance copywriter producing sales material for Alias Wavefront, a then leading CGI firm that was inventing all kinds of never seen VFX that would blow people away. One of the engineers I worked with told me something I never forgot. Your imagination has more polygons than anything you can create with our software. He was talking about why it was critical to have some of the action happen in the shadows. All of this is why series tend to go downhill. The first volume in any series leaves so much to the imagination. The map of the world is barely fleshed out. The characters' biographies are full of blank spots. The mechanics of the artifacts and the politics of the land are all just detailed enough that your mind automatically ascribes a level of detail to them without knowing what that detail is. This is the moment at which everything seems very clever, because your mind is just churning with all the different bits of elaborate lore that will fill in these lacunae and make them all fit together. All right, here is your spoiler alert. I'm about to give some spoilers for Furiosa. I'm going to give you a second to decide whether you want to listen to these. Once again, this is your moment to decide whether you want to hear some Furiosa spoilers. Meow, meow. All right, here come those Furiosa spoilers. Last night, we went to see Furiosa, the latest Mad Max movie, a prequel to 2015's Fury Road, which is one of the greatest movies ever made. Like most prequels, Furiosa functions as a lore delivery vehicle, and as such, it's nowhere near as good as Fury Road. Fury Road hints at so much world-building. We learn about the three fortresses of the Wasteland, the Citadel, the Bullet Farm, and Gastown, but we only see one, the Citadel. We learn that these three cities have a symbiotic relationship with one another, defined by a complex politics that is just barely stable. We meet Furiosa herself and learn something of her biography, that she had been stolen from the Green Place, that she had suffered an arm amputation. All of this is left for us to fill in, and for a decade, my hindbrain has been chewing on all of that, coming up with cool ways it could all fit together. I yearned to know the real explanation, but it was always unlikely that this real explanation would be as enjoyable as my own partial, ever unfinished headcanon. Furiosa is a great movie, but its worst parts are the canonical lore it settles. Partly, it's because some of that lore is just stupid. Why is the bullet farm an open pit mine? I mean, it's visually amazing, but what does that have to do with making bullets? Sometimes, though, it's because the lore is banal. The solarpunk green place is a million times less cool than I had imagined it. Sometimes, it's because the lore is banal and stupid. The scene where Furiosa's arm is crushed, then severed, then replaced, it's both rushed and quasi-miraculous. But even if the lore had been good, not stupid, not banal, the best they could have hoped for was for that lore to be tidy. If it were surprising, it would seem contrived. A story whose loose ends have been tidily snipped away seems like it would be immensely satisfying, but it's not satisfying, it's just resolved. Like the band performing every encore you demand until you no longer want to hear the band anymore, the feeling as you leave the hall isn't satisfaction, it's exhaustion. So long as some key questions remain unresolved, you're still wanting more. So long as the map has blank spots, your hindbrain will impute clever and exciting mysteries, tantalizingly teetering on the edge of explicability, to that story. Lore is always better as something to anticipate than it is to receive. The fans demand lore, but it should be doled out sparingly. Always leave them wanting more. All right, no recording next week. I will instead be in Amherst, New York. Those of you who are Buffalonians, I hope will come out and see me, and I hope you have a great week. And next time I talk to you, I'll tell you all about Talking Heads. All right, see you next time.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, WRYNECK Studio, @gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time, self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.